march to the beat of your own drum. And if someone likes the rhythm, they'll dance. I mean, it's like, I'm not for everyone. Everyone is not for everyone, but you should be for yourself, right? Like, you should at least make you happy, because you're not guaranteed to be able to make everyone happy you come across. So find your best self and be that person.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we are celebrating LGBTQ plus professionals in a special series for Pride Month 2023. I'm joined today by Dr. Safi Mojidi, who describes himself as a point guard of cyber and data privacy. He is the founder and CEO of Hacking the Workforce, which co-creates employment opportunities for queer and trans people of color to upskill their lives and move from empowered to employed in cybersecurity. He is a board member and director of partnerships at Trans Tech Social Enterprises, and has had a long career in cybersecurity. Welcome, Safi. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about your background. Where did you grow up and what were your early interests?
Sure. Yes. So I grew up actually in Silver Spring, Maryland. I immigrated from Nigeria, where I was originally born. So I've been in the DMV area on and off for, the last 20 years or so.
And what was your initial interest? I know you've recently received your doctorate. Congratulations on that. But what was your early education? What path did that take?
Yeah, so I think I have always just been traditionally interested in technology and computers and gadgets. And I mean, I think for the most part, a lot of people who end up in my profession have been tinkerers one way or another. So I really just enjoyed taking apart computers, putting them back together. And then when the internet boomed, if you will, started getting really into web design, websites, and then some coding. And then from there, started to really try to understand what systems and applications and what made up the things that were inside of computers. So my undergrad, I got my bachelor's of science in computer science, and then I had a minor in writing and rhetoric. So it was kind of interesting combination of backgrounds. I enjoyed being technical, but also enjoyed writing and reading policy and things like that. I was out of undergrad for about 2 years, and I decided I think I needed to get a little bit more education. So I went back and got my master's in information assurance and security. And that kind of coincided with my career kind of taking off. I had the opportunity to support NASA pretty early on in my cybersecurity career. So I think between my formal education and some opportunities that I had the opportunity of having, I was able to kind of solidify that I wanted to make a career out of information security and cybersecurity.
Well, it certainly seems like it will be an area of burgeoning demand. And you describe yourself as a point guard, which I think is a wonderful term because it really does evoke someone who is critical in the game and in the process. So what does that mean to you, being a point guard?
Yeah, so I've always been an athlete. I grew up playing sports. I actually was on the Nigerian national team. I had the opportunity to compete at the World Cup games. And so I played sports at some pretty high levels, and I know how significant athletics and sports in general still to this day play an integral role in my life, just from the way I approach problems and just having the foundation of understanding that when you're on a team or when you're working with other people, you have a specific role to do and responsibilities that you need to take care of. And just having that, like I said, foundational level of teamwork and what it takes to communicate with different types of people, but you're all of the same understanding that we're trying to get something done, right? And accomplish a goal together. And so I think cybersecurity is a team sport, right? So if I am an executive or someone in charge of leading a cyber program, I know that I'm not going to be successful unless I have the buy-in from other people at the executive level, but also the entire organization as a whole, and making sure that everyone understands, like, I can't do it myself, right? I'm here, I'm responsible for it happening, but it's going to take all of us. And I think that kind of permeates into a few other parts of my life, right? So at Hacking the Workforce, I like to try to help people understand and like set them up for success, right? Help them understand the game, but then help them understand success in cybersecurity, particularly LGBTQ people of color. So I've been in the industry for about 15 years now. And I know I've had allies, teammates, mentors. It kind of takes the whole team. As an underrepresented minority in cybersecurity, it's very difficult to write your own ticket without having some other people involved in helping to promote your voice or help you see your value when sometimes you're questioning it yourself. So I really just kind of approach life most broadly, I think, as a team sport, right? Like when you're raising a family, you hear it takes a community. And I think that same kind of ethos is important when we are trying to build a culture that is inclusive in cybersecurity, right? Like we need everyone on essentially both sides of the aisle.
And before we move into the work you're doing around inclusion and training, which is absolutely critical, I really want to discuss that. Can you go back and talk us through your own transition and that journey?
Yeah, sure. So it was probably been about 6 years now, and I was having difficulty seeing or feeling like I was at home in my body, if you will. So a lot of the self-work that I had to do really helped me get to a place with therapy and friends and family being super supportive. There was a time when I essentially had to choose what I mentioned, like my background in sports was it was a huge component of who I was. And I was playing semi-pro tackle football on a women's team at the time. And I was starting to feel a sense of dissonance between my outward expression versus who I felt I was internally. And so I essentially had to create who I thought I saw on the outside. And so that looked like medically transitioning. And from the time I entered the workforce, part of the reason why I hesitated to transition was fear of what other people would think, or how am I able to show up at work? Am I going to be supported? Am I going to create issues, so to speak, right? Like being able to be an advocate for myself, making sure people use the right pronouns, making sure people understood that I knew how to advocate for myself. And I understand that that's something that comes with privilege. That's not something that a lot of particularly Black and or trans people have the confidence in doing for themselves. And I completely understand it. It is very difficult to be that first, right, at any organization or at a place where people have known you for a significant amount of time as one gender or presenting one way. And I had to choose my own happiness as opposed to the myriad of other reasons why I could not, or told myself that I could not, transition. So I think it was a huge lesson in figuring out who I was, but also thrust into a position where because I am proud and I'm visible, right, in the cybersecurity space, in the tech space as a Black trans man, I know that it's important for other people who potentially are struggling with something similar to what I struggled with to be able to see someone who's visible. I know it was difficult for me, partly because there was no mentor, Black trans mentor that I could go talk to about, hey, how did you do this? How did things materialize? What were some things that you would have told your younger self? Or what types of situations may you have avoided? Just the things that you never want to experience twice in life. And if you can help it, why not hopefully prevent someone from experiencing it, or experiencing it to the extent that you had to experience it, right? So I think that kind of, again, just ties back to some of the work that I'm doing because of my lived experience and my positionality. I have a very unique position, and hopefully with some of the initiatives that myself and Hacking Workforce have going on, we can lessen the occurrence of stuff like that happening to people.
For sure. I'd love to maybe just dig into some of those things. Had you had a mentor you would have liked to know, have known, and maybe what would you say to somebody else going through the same thing? If you were going to be the mentor that you never had, what would be some of those concrete maybe pieces of advice that you'd give that person? What did you do concretely? I know that you said you worked remotely. Maybe that helped. You didn't have to go to a workplace presenting one way, one day, another way, another day. Any tips that you would pass on now?
Yes, definitely. I think I say this, but I also want people to understand, I understand that people have to eat, right? However, there are more important things such as your health than money or a paycheck, right? So if you have options for getting out of a potentially unhealthy, toxic environment, explore those. Choose yourself, right? I think a lot of what I was missing was a community. And that's one of our core pillars is building community and hacking the workforce. Because when things like what someone experiences in a toxic workplace environment, when things like that are happening, a lot of times you're almost gaslit into believing that they're not happening. So trust yourself, trust your instincts. If there's a pit in your stomach every time you talk to someone and you're not comfortable with comments people are making and you don't feel comfortable in that situation speaking up, explore other options for employment, explore other options for support. I think it's really important that as a marginalized community, we build networks and connections outside of when we need them specifically, right? So just understanding that we do have a different experience when it comes to accessing healthcare, for example, right? Like that's a huge barrier for people getting the treatment, the care, access to care that they need from my community, right? And I'm talking not only from the trans community, but also the Black and Brown community, right? Or communities that traditionally are a little behind when it comes to seeing the value and usefulness of mental health and therapy, right? So I would really want people to know that you should be talking to people, right? You shouldn't keep these things that are happening to you inside because it's not good for you, right? Physiologically. And so I'd want people to know that you are not a one of one, right? Like there are other people who have gone through and can hopefully help you through what you're going through. And it's okay to need help, right? Like there are resources and support for that reason. And we particularly know that there aren't a lot of people who are well-equipped to help you navigate some of those challenges because of how intersectional they are in nature. So I definitely advocate for people advocating for themselves first and foremost, but definitely finding your community and finding your advocates in that community.
Pretty powerful. Moving now to inclusion in the workplace. So you've been in the workplace for many years. You've seen it from many angles. And that's your focus now is on indeed creating employment opportunities. We used to talk about moving from empowered to employed, because as you said, people do need to eat. How would you say the inclusion level or representation level of LGBTQ plus professionals has changed over the course of your career?
I think the inclusivity of LGBTQ people overall has changed. I think that it is more positive in terms of acceptance and people understanding that, I don't want to say these people or we, but it's hard. It's very hard for someone in 2023 to not know someone who is part of the LGBTQ community, right? I think what hasn't changed or what potentially is getting worse is inclusivity for people who are LGBTQ and another marginalized identity, right? So I think it becomes challenging for organizations to be able to support the whole person as opposed to the holiday or the event that is happening, right? So I think inclusivity has changed for LGBTQ people because there are more structural organizational programs that support LGBTQ people in and of themselves. However, I think that's not where true marginalization comes from, right? Because in that LGBTQ population, if we're not talking about the intersection of race, for example, those demographics are very different from if we were to talk to the people of color who are LGBTQ at that organization, right? So as we start turning what a marginalized community could look like on its head and not just kind of looking at, are they LGBTQ? Because I think in and of itself, there are enough programs that support LGBTQ people in the workplace today. Unfortunately, I think where the gap is how are we making sure that there's equity in the support that we provide, right? So if we're providing support for a cis white gay man, right? That level of support would look different from the level of support that would be needed from a Black trans woman, for example, right? Just from the perspective of where those people are demographically, those two audiences require something different, right?
It's really interesting and quite depressing what you say, I have to say, because I would have liked to have heard something different, that we were getting more appreciative of intersectionality and the challenges it presents. And I wonder whether it's a question of people's budget Is there a budget for tolerance and inclusion that maybe runs out of steam or runs out of resources? And I think it's interesting. We're certainly getting very good at celebrating all the holidays. There's no question that we now have a Juneteenth parade, for example, in our local village. And we have more holidays that we represent, and Pride Month will be universally celebrated, as we've discussed. But I wonder whether, if we step back and ask the why are we celebrating this? And, you know, like its original cause, maybe that would inform better behaviors instead of just feeling that the box is ticked because it's been celebrated.
Yeah. And to that point, it kind of gets back to like what my dissertation was on, honestly. And that's the concept of digital trust, right? So where I'm going with this is, one way to look at this is, we've done it, whoever the organization, right? Whatever they define it as, right? The definition of done to them. If they are putting a checkbox by that, but they aren't implementing changes in a meaningful way, I think that that essentially could be a business discriminator, right? So if by default, I'm not as inclusive internally as I'm outwardly expressing, right? How does that in turn affect the company's reputation, the perception of inclusivity to the public, right? What are the company's employees saying about them? And what are their actual demographics, right? Like if they needed to publish or someone asked them for those numbers, if those numbers didn't actually reflect what they had been saying, right? Like now does your competitor who is able to prove that, does your competitor now have a competitive advantage because they are able to demonstrate those things in practice, not just in compliance activities, right? So I think to a certain degree, people do care, right? People care more, right? So when we think about it in the cybersecurity space, once you've had a breach, right? Once you've shown up in the news, once the FCC or someone needs to fine you for some type of data breach, and that breach negatively affected a marginalized community, what does that do for the services you're able to provide? Does that now mean people are leery of using your services, don't trust you as an organization? I think particularly these days, data is the commodity, right? And if someone is making a conscious decision to use your competitor's service because of reputation, whatever comes with that, right? From a cybersecurity perspective, privacy perspective, and or just, are you a good organization? Like socially, are you practicing socially conscious capitalism, right? Like those are some of the questions that I think communities, particularly those that come from marginalized populations, are starting to ask themselves. And if organizations can't answer the way that they need to, I think it will start to affect their bottom line.
And moving, that's a fascinating area, digital trust. Something else that I know is very close to your heart is training and skilling.
Yes.
Can you talk about that and where the gaps are currently and what you're trying to do about it?
Yes, definitely. I think traditionally there's a dearth of diversity in cybersecurity. There's a dearth of minorities in training positions or in positions to affect training that is rolled out to entire populations. So specifically, there's some organizations that are global in size and very front and center in terms of creating content and creating new certifications for the cybersecurity industry. I think some of the challenges that I've seen are if there's not enough inclusion in the people who are creating the training material, then how can we be confident that that lack of diversity, lived experience, diversification of thought, that that isn't negatively filtering into the subject matter, right? Or how we're explaining the subject matter. Are we accidentally creating opportunities for bias in examples that we're using to convey foundational level topics, right? So are we using examples that 15, 20% of the population has never even heard of while trying to also understand a very new, important concept to cybersecurity, right? So some of the things that I've found is that the research instruments that are used to collect data on the cybersecurity industry or the tech industry, themselves are not inclusive, right? So you have a survey instrument that asks gender in the binary or does not leave space for someone to identify as having some sort of neurodivergence or accurately categorizing people's race, right? So some of what I'm finding is some of the data that we have around training is very binary, and the examples that are used, which one would assume, are very tailored to specific demographics as opposed to being somewhat to the contrary, right? So just not to creating examples for training material and or questions on certifications that are inclusive and help people understand as opposed to just a certain demographic.
And you spoke about your journey and how you had some resilience, and you mentioned that maybe others might not have. You knew about raising your own visibility and advocating. Were there any setbacks or challenges throughout that journey that you learned lessons from that maybe you can share?
Definitely. I think I, as I mentioned, was fortunate to have mentors or advocates who could help me realize my value in certain senses, but in certain scenarios, for example, them giving me advice or, hey, here are the things that work for me. And most of those advocates, honestly, being cishet white men, they were giving me advice that worked for me. And it sounded like good advice. However, I started to bump up against, I am not them and they are not me. So the things that had gotten them to that point and the things that had gotten me to the point in which I was, where I was essentially crossing from middle management to senior management, those things didn't necessarily work for me, right? I started to learn that your network is your net worth. And I know a lot of people have said that, but it truly is the higher you hope to climb in the corporate ladder, if you will, or in an organization. It really is about who you know and being able to add value to an organization based on what you do know, right? Like once you're connected with the person or the organization who needs your services, then adding value by demonstrating that you can rise to the challenge of whatever the job is. And I think those instances that happened more than once kind of helped me understand that my lived identity, the way I present at work, my experiences from like a healthcare requirement perspective, those are very nuanced experiences. And while there are a lot of people like me, there are not a lot of people who have come before me who are visible that can kind of help me navigate that road. And I think it's important to be visible because, again, a lot of the issues that we face being Black and being trans are issues that a lot of people aren't comfortable talking about and or hearing about. So it's not lost upon me that I've had the opportunity to be in rooms that I otherwise might not have been had it not been for some allies. But I kind of think it's my responsibility to help other people in my community get into some of those rooms as well.
And I want to tie this back to your time playing sport, because you mentioned sport as giving you the appreciation for teamwork and teaching you how to play in a team. Often sport at that level, certainly playing on a national team, teaches you a lot about yourself, maybe your attitude to winning, to losing, your own personal resilience. Do you ever trace some of that, your current personality and where you are today, back to that?
Definitely. And most recently in finishing my dissertation, I think there was a few nights when I had sports on in the background or put on in basketball or most sports, you call it like a warm-up mix, right? So like a song to get you hype and like get you excited and get you going. And there were definitely a few nights where I was in that type of mental environment because it was like, I have to get through this and I enjoy it. However, it is work, and music for me is typically the way I can kind of just focus and just knock out the things that need to be done. So I think from that perspective, the hard work portion of it definitely comes from playing sports and just battling through adversity. And it's not a setback, right? It's a setup for success. So I kind of just look at it that way. That's been the way that I think I've been able to be most successful, is kind of challenging myself to rise to the occasion and get done what needs to get done.
And just down to final few questions now. It's funny how many people actually do trace much of their success today to their success in sport. And they're learning, because it teaches, it really is a microcosm or a petri dish for life. So no surprise, your answer there. And just around any key people, maybe, or mentors or people who believed in you that you think were influential in your life?
Yes, definitely. I mean, my mom is definitely top of that list. She has been very influential. I think as a whole, there have been several people. Angelica Ross, she is an awesome woman, just huge advocate for the Black and trans community, is the founder of Trans Tech, and just one of those people who truly speaks life into people and helps them, like, with a loving, endearing, get your stuff together, you can do this type of way. Definitely a huge supporter of mine. I had the opportunity to see her the other day in Atlanta, actually. She gave me a huge hug and was, you know, congratulations, because I actually just defended my dissertation. So people who are part of the community, I mean, my wife, like anyone who's an advocate and who has advocated on my behalf or for my community, I think those are the people who kind of keep me going. And I know I can always count on my executive director at Hacking the Workforce, Nicole Patton, just a powerhouse of an ED. The common trend there is Black women. I think Black women are amazing. And I am very lucky and very blessed to have come across some of the women I've come across with and still have my life on a day-to-day basis. So,
well, that's certainly very powerful to have that network. And my last question is around any advice you would have for your younger self or any creed or motto that you live by. And I know that you said that was something you wish maybe you'd heard from someone else earlier in your life.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. I think the largest or like most applicable one is march to the beat of your own drum. And if someone likes the rhythm, they'll dance. I mean, it's like, I'm not for everyone. Everyone is not for everyone, but you should be for yourself, right? Like, you should at least make you happy, because you're not guaranteed to be able to make everyone happy you come across. So find your best self and be that person.
Well, thank you so much, Safi. You are really a beacon for this community. And I think what you've done to highlight some of the struggles of intersectionality is really giving voice to something that we haven't discussed enough on this podcast. So thank you for the organization that you're running, for the work that you're doing in upskilling and in turning a whole generation, hopefully, from empowered to employed. Thank you for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice. And all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest. I was made to be-